Hare
Every living entity, being Godhead's parts and parcel, is it everyone's duty to cooperate with him by performing transcendent loving service. And then two, good works, salvation by knowledge or perfection by mystic powers, are all subordinate to the transcendent loving service of the Lord. And it's everyone's duty to cooperate, but in that cooperation, then these considerations of good work, salvation by knowledge and perfection by mystic power are all subordinate to the transcendent loving service of the Lord. Because otherwise we may get the idea that, you know, all these nice things are good, right? That's the general tendency, because nice things give nice results, right? The living entity wants nice results. So therefore the natural mistake will be, therefore, good work is devotional service, right? Knowledge is devotional service. Mystic power is devotional service, right? But a subordinate devotional service can be used in the Lord's service, right, as part of the process of devotion, but it is not never equal to devotion. That's always important to note, you know, because otherwise we'll think, oh, he's, you know, he's nice, so he's a good devotee. Or he's not nice, he's not a good devotee. It may have something to do with it, right? It may have, he's developed good qualities because of devotional service. But you have to, you know, see, you know, more. But it couldn't be, he's just conditionally good, nice. So we'll take it, he's a good devotee, right? But it's like, no, he's a nice person, he's a pious person. Therefore, following the culture and practices of Krishna consciousness will be easy for him, right, rather than the difficulty. So it's an advantage, yes, but it's not that that being nice, that's the devotional service. Okay, then you're on 647. And of all yogis, the one with great faith who always abides in me, thinks of me within himself, and renders transcendental loving service to me, he is the most intimately united with me in yoga and is the highest of all. That is my opinion, right? So here again we get Krishna's opinion. So otherwise they'll speak according to what's the scriptures, because what he feels, that's how the scriptures are written. How the scriptures are written, that's how Krishna acts. Right? One of his 64 qualities is he always acts according to scriptures. Right? Of course, he wrote the scriptures, but, you know, he acts according to that. You know, that's the point, is that you establish something, you have to follow it. Right? So even if someone establishes something bogus, you have to follow it. Right? Because that's the rule. What you establish is what you follow. So therefore, better to follow what God does. So here, then, because the scripture will give so many directions for different mentalities in different situations, then there may be so many varieties. But here, when he says that is my opinion, means that is the highest of all the forms that are made available. Yes.
So it's to emphasize that this point is important?
Yes. Yeah, when he says, this is my opinion. Means the other things he'll be talking about, these are correct. After many, many births, who actually in knowledge surrenders into me, knowing me is the cause of all cause and all this. Such a great soul is very rare. You know, that's a fact. You know, these things are here. But here is that one with great faith always abides in me, thinks of me, and renders transcendental loving service to me. Because one could say, you know, one, you know, following Varnashram, or, you know, the proper knowledge and all that, or renunciation, you know, or doing good works, all these different things. But one may consider that those are ways to focus. Right? Does that make sense? Because somebody's starting with good work. Right? And he likes to do good work, or at least he knows he should do good work, right? And so he's doing good work. And then he's connecting that good work to Krishna, right? Or knowledge. He knows the material world, we're not supposed to be attached to it. So therefore, taking renunciation as the focal point, he works with renunciation and therefore connects that to Krishna. Does that make sense? Or he takes knowledge, right? It's by knowledge that we'll get out of the material, so we take knowledge and connect that to Krishna. Right? But here Krishna says, so these are all processes, and they're all bona fide. That's why I say Krishna will give a whole list of bona fide options. You know, then we see that he may then say, you know, like this. So having faith in Krishna, always abiding in Krishna, thinking of Krishna within himself, and rendering service. That's actually the highest. Right? So it's not how much knowledge you have, how much renunciation you have, how much good work you're doing. It's whether it's all connected to him. So therefore, they're starting with him. And because of him, that's why they're doing good work. You know what I'm saying? Does that make sense? That's, the devotee is the highest yogi. The ideal yogi concentrates his attention on Krishna, who is called Shyamasundara, who is as beautifully decorated as a cloud, whose lotus-like face is as effulgent as the sun, whose dress is brilliant with jewels, and whose body is flower-garlanded. Illuminating all sides is his glorious luster, which is called the Brahma-jyoti. He incarnates in different forms, such as Rama, Narsingha, Varaha, and Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And he descends like a human being as the son of Mother Jashoda. And he is known as Krishna, Govinda, and Vasudeva. He is the perfect child, husband, friend, and master. And he is full with all opulences and transcendental qualities. One remains fully conscious of these features of the Lord. He is called the highest yogi. Right? Because the yogi, he is learning to pull himself out of the material focus and bring it into focus on the super soul. But here is that he can focus without faith and without rendering transcendental service. So he can be always thinking of him, right? Otherwise, how would he be a yogi? But it's because he has faith in Krishna and renders service to Krishna. That's what then makes it the highest yoga. Right? Because otherwise, these others, mechanically it works, but it's not that these systems can't be used. The karma, the jnana, the dhyana, yoga can't be used. It's just that they're only used in connection with Krishna. They're subordinate to devotional service, right? They're not the service. Okay? They're the medium or the expression of service. Riti. Lesson 8 established that all spiritual processes have meaning only when they are followed in connection with the Lord. Right? Lesson 9 shows the miserable result of practicing them independently. Right? So here we see Krishna will explain what's proper first, and then what's improper. Because you want to know what the standard is. Just like if you're giving rules, you establish first the common rule, right? The general rule that always works. Then, having understood that principle, then you can get into exceptions. Right? Otherwise, if you start with all the exceptions, you'll get confused, because the exception is specific. Well, the general always works. So always thinking of Krishna, that works in the material world and in the spiritual world. Right? But then the exceptions of not thinking of the Lord, that's only for the material world. So that's actually the smaller. Does that make sense? Yeah. Lesson 9. Knowledge for salvation without attainment of transcendent loving service of Godhead leads simply to accepting unnecessary suffering. Right? So now we're talking about the jnani. Right? Mm. So accepting the path of jnana without seeing it in connection to devotional service, it says, leads simply to accepting unnecessary suffering. Right? Because that renunciation will generate suffering. So it's unnecessary. Right? So much suffering is there. It's not necessary for the living entity. The living entity is not by nature suffering, right? He's such an ananda. Right? Does that make sense? 12.5. For those whose minds are attached to the unmanifested, impersonal feature of the Supreme, advancement is very troublesome. To make progress in that discipline is always difficult for those who are embodied. So he's pointing out just the path itself is troublesome. As we remember, before he's saying about the path of devotional service, it's joyfully performed. Right? Because it's in relation to someone, right? It gives happiness and all. The renunciation doesn't give happiness. The only thing is the renunciation, by practicing it, then one can detach oneself from the material world. So the material world itself, involving in it, is miserable. Right? So by detaching from it, you save yourself from that misery. But to get rid of that misery, then you have to accept this misery. You know what I'm saying? Like that. So all it is again, back to what we were saying before, is the mind, whatever it accepts as happiness, then we will define that as happiness. Right? So for the karmi, renunciation, he will not call that happiness. He'll call engaging the senses happiness. Right? But because that doesn't do anything for you, then the jnani will consider not engaging the senses as happiness. Right? And engaging the senses is unhappiness. But in either case, because you're dealing with material, both are unpleasant. Right? But because the one is in the mode of goodness, then its unpleasantness is less disturbing. But it's still unnecessary. Well, mode of passion, ignorance, then that's always greater misery. Right? But you have to remember, as the person in ignorance doesn't notice the misery so much. Right? Does that make sense? You know, a dog. How often do you see a dog take a bath? Right? I mean, what do you feel like if you haven't taken bath for some time? Right? A dog, right? You know? So now, that's been, you know, a day or two or something like that. But could you imagine a whole lifetime of that? But they don't notice. They just take it as normal. That's the mode of ignorance. Right? Mode of passion. So much trouble, endeavor, with so many obstacles. Right? But because they're so focused on what they're going to get from it and that will make them happy, they don't notice the amount of trouble. You know what I'm saying? They'll be more sensitive to the person in ignorance. But you know what I'm saying? He stays at a better hotel, it's cleaner, it's nicer, greater facility. Like that. But it's still the trouble he takes to get it. That's another thing. The person in the mode of ignorance may not take so much trouble because he doesn't have the drive. But his situation is very miserable, right? The person in the mode of passion will situate himself very nicely, but the endeavor he takes is very troublesome, right? So here then, in the mode of goodness also, then the trouble is less, but they're more sensitive because of being situated in goodness. So it's just as much of a botheration. Does that make sense? You know, it's like we're sitting there and there's one fly that's persistent and we're going nuts. Right? Yeah, I mean, this is driving me crazy, right? Yeah, but then you have, you know, up north you have a caribou and he's covered with hundreds of them, right? And they're driving him nuts. You know, so it's just, it's the same thing. If there was one fly, the caribou couldn't care less, right? He's got hundreds of them. Now this is going to drive him nuts. You know, if we had hundreds of them, we'd probably die, right? You know, like that. So, but, you know, does that make sense? You understand what I'm saying? So the point is the experience of misery is the same, even though the volume is different. Does that make sense? The difference between Jnana Yoga and Bhakti Yoga. The group of transcendentalists who follow the path of the inconceivable, unmanifested, impersonal feature of the Supreme Lord are called Jnana Yogis. And persons who are in full Krishna consciousness, engaged in devotional service to the Lord, are called Bhakti Yogis. Now, here the difference between the Jnana Yoga and Bhakti Yoga is definitely expressed. The process of Jnana Yoga, although ultimately bringing one to the same goal, is very troublesome. Whereas the path of Bhakti Yoga, the process of being in direct service to the Supreme Personality of Godhead, is easier and is natural for the embodied soul. Because for the soul, rendering service to the Lord, that's what's natural. Not rendering service to the Lord, that's unnatural. And then not rendering service to the Lord and not engaging the senses in anything, that's really not. That's really trouble. Right? Does that make sense? In other words, the you could also look at it that the trouble that they're talking about, it's not necessarily that the trouble itself is very great. You know what I'm saying? You know, it's like to not overeat. Okay? It's not a great endeavor. You know what I'm saying? You know, as opposed to, you know, stuffing yourself, you know, like that, where you can't even move, right? You know, that's more endeavor. Right? But what's being pointed out is that for the soul to not be engaged in activity, that's a great problem. Does that make sense? That's the very troublesome aspect. Yes.
This is in the last two paragraphs mentioned. For embodied and for the embodied soul. The embodied means that the body needs action or...
Yeah, embodied, I would think there's one aspect is because we're dealing with the jnanis. Right? And so they're going to be focused on the soul and not on the form. Right? Because they consider forms to be a disturbance, a distraction. So then by saying the embodied soul, then you're pointing out the same point they can relate to. But you're also leaving the element that having a body is normal. So you have the normal body, but this is, you have been embodied. Because it's not the natural body of the soul. Right? The spiritual body is the normal body, because that and the soul are non-different. Here, then, the soul has been put in a body. But to not engage the body, that's unnatural. That's why he uses the word. It's easier and natural. Easier because the mind, you know, because of the relationships, you know, and the pleasantness of doing something for somebody, right? Everyone likes doing good work. Because of the pleasantness, you know it's good, it's beneficial, it's pleasing something. So, and it's natural because the soul by nature is a person and has a body, is active. So it's very natural. So the other, it's not natural. You can also look at it, embodied soul, is that even though they're in the conditioned state, still the devotional service is still easier and nicer. Because you could take it that, no, when you're in your spiritual form, okay, then it's natural and it's easy. But when you're in the material form, then it's not going to be natural or easy. Like that. So the living entity being engaged within the material phenomena, that's unnatural. Right? So therefore, you have to follow the path of giving all that up. Right? But as was being discussed yesterday, the idea of what does giving it up mean? Right? Giving it up doesn't necessarily mean not physically dealing with it, not engaging the senses in the activity. It means giving up the result of the activity. Right? Because we have to remember thinking, feeling, and willing. Thinking means we're contemplating it. There's a desire. There's some enthusiasm. But feeling means the result that will be gained from endeavor we have an attachment to or a need for, right? Then there's willing. We will perform the activity. So it is all about the goal. Right? So if we see that the goal is connected to the Lord, then there's no problem. But if the goal is not connected to the Lord, then it's a problem. So not understanding this point, then people will say, no, the activity shouldn't be performed. But if the activity is not performed, yes, you do not technically entangle yourself, but you haven't actually, and you may raise yourself to liberation, but you haven't done anything that's actually for the soul. Right? So that's troublesome. Right? It's not for the soul. The soul is endeavoring and getting a result. But the natural position is that result is for Krishna. The unnatural position is the results for ourselves. Right? So this whole point of who's the result for? That's the whole. You want to do something, fine, but who's the result for? Right? The guy wants to smoke a cigarette. What's the result of smoking the cigarette for? Who's going to get the benefit?
Nobody.
Right, of course, yeah. That's even more troublesome, right? The path of the chain smoker is very troublesome. Yeah.
You know. But short. But short.
Yeah, but yes, but short. So the the engagement of the senses is natural, but not for yourself. It means if we think about it, yeah, we'll get into detail. But yeah, that doesn't come up. Okay, does that make sense? The process of jnana yoga is troublesome. So, for a devotee, there is no difficulty in approaching the Supreme immediately and directly, because he's a Supreme Person. But here, the inconceivable, unmanifested, impersonal feature of the Supreme, that's hard to approach. Right? You know, what's the relationship? Right? There isn't, because there's no manifestation, how is there interaction? There isn't. The interaction is through the manifestation. So we understand it's Krishna. It's his Brahma. That's what's pervading everything. So we see Krishna's qualities in everything. Where we're seeing the person, that's what makes it so easy. But to try to have a relationship with something that you can't have a relationship with, that's very difficult. You know what I'm saying? But for those who are following the impersonal way to spiritual realization, the path is difficult. They have to understand the unmanifested representation of the Supreme through such Vedic literatures as the Upanishads. And they have to learn the language, understand the non-perceptual feelings, and realize all these processes. This is not very easy for a common man. Right? So literature such as the Upanishads. Right? So that means the Puranas and other literatures are more easily approachable because of the story form that they're in, right? There's people talking, relating it to practical situations that they're in, that they come across in their life. So it's much more accessible. The Upanishads, then you're dealing with, you know, the very essential philosophical points. And not only that, it's not direct. It's not like Bhagavatam, right? It's indirect. You know, that he walks, he does not walk. He's near, but he's very far. Now, that's a lot of trouble to figure that out. Right? It's so much easier. He doesn't have senses like us. Therefore, his legs are transcendental. So he doesn't walk in the material, but he walks in the spirit, on the spiritual platform. You know, very much easier. Right? Not as poetic, but, you know, like that. To learn the language, because then in here you have the words themselves, each syllable has meaning, so you have to know what is there so you get exact meanings. Otherwise you'll get something different. You'll end up with something else. Like that. You know? How you say? Understand the non-perceptual feelings, right? It's easy to understand the perceptual feelings, but the non-perceptual feelings. But at the same time as they can't be connected to the senses. right? So the experience of it. So be able to experience the Brahman platform. Right? That's difficult. Right? Many people can't even experience what's obviously right in front of them. Right? You have play some nice music, and for the uncultured man, it doesn't mean anything. It's right there. So let alone it's unperceptible. Right? Right. So he has to realize all that together. So what the Shastra says, the language, what it's saying about that, the non-perceptual feelings, all that at once, you know, then that's difficult. Each one of them is difficult, let alone putting them all together. So therefore, it's not easy for a common man. A person in Krishna consciousness, engaged in devotional service simply by the guidance of the bona fide spiritual master, simply by offering regulative obeisances unto the deity, simply by hearing the glories of the Lord, and simply by eating the remnants of foodstuffs offered to the bucket. It's actually the foodstuffs, and I was thinking of your bucket. Now I just thinking here, yeah. So all the food offered into the bucket. So now you can take the bucket and say it's time for the bucket offering. You have to offer food into the bucket.
Yeah.
Okay. There was once a devotee. I don't know if they see them now, but they used to have it. It was a standard, like a sadhu. One of paraphernalia, so that they had their own unique kind of paraphernalia. There was this brass cup. It was about this long. I think it like held a liter of water, you know? Long. It had a handle on it, you know, that went up, and I think it was for hanging on things. And it was, you know, because you couldn't really sit it down nicely because it had a very small bottom. And there was this one devotee that he had one of those, you know, in the early 70s. So he was in Mayapur. So in the Kajar Ras, date Ras, the date, what do you call it? The date sap season, date Ras season. Then he would get out his bucket like that. And then, that was it. Because you could tie a rope onto it, use it as a bucket. You could take back to get water. But at the same time, it was also the size you could use it for drinking. So it was very multi-purpose, right? You know, you could carry around a big bucket. Just like this. So he would start down at Hulargad with the guys that have the Kajaras. So they come with their two pots, right? And so in his cup, you know, he could do pretty good. So he'd finish all that guy's Ras. Then he'd move up until he got up to like Yogpit, you know, finish off all the Kajaras between Hulargad and Hulargad. So that was, you know, offered to the bucket. Yes. So you can take inspiration.
Yeah.
Like that. So you can check it out. Anytime, next time you're in Varanasi or in Haridwar, you can check out one of those sadhu buckets.
Okay. Sounds good.
Okay. And simply by eating the remnants of foodstuffs offered to the Lord. Does that mean from the buckets, right? Yeah.
Exactly.
Realizes the Supreme Personality of Godhead very easily. Because you're engaging the senses. It's natural. People want to eat. People want to be active. People want to see nice things, hear nice things, talk nice things. So that can be done. But to not talk, not see, not smell, not taste, that's a problem. Right? You know? Like that. You know, it's like, you know, when you're in trouble, then they stick you in the corner or stick you somewhere with nothing to do, right? So this is that they voluntarily do that, you know. You know, it's like lifetime detention, right? You know, it's like. There is no doubt that the impersonalists are unnecessarily taking a troublesome path, with the risk of not realizing the absolute truth at the ultimate end, because they don't know the ultimate truth. Right? But the personalist, without any risk, trouble or difficulty, approaches the Supreme Personality of Godhead directly. A similar passage appears in Srimad Bhagavatam. It is stated there that if one ultimately has to surrender unto the Supreme Personality of Godhead, this surrendering process is called bhakti, but instead takes the trouble to understand what is Brahman and what is not Brahman, and spends his whole life in that way, the result is simply troublesome. Therefore, it is advised here that one should not take up this troublesome path of self-realization, because there is uncertainty in the ultimate result, because you don't know if you'll get to the Supreme Person. You may get up to the Brahman platform. It's trouble. So getting there will be difficult. And then whether from there you'll move on to understanding the personality of Godhead, it's quite doubtful. Right? So it's so much trouble, and the results are not guaranteed. Well, devotional service, it's direct. You're approaching the Supreme Lord directly. It's natural for the living entity, and it's guaranteed you will, you know, reach the Supreme Lord. Yes.
I was wondering, it seems like maybe the scriptures like the Upanishads, they are kind of confusing at all. Are they here because you have jivas who like have such a false ego about their knowledge? I mean, is it to really like facilitate their false ego that they want to like feel that they know this knowledge that other people don't know? Because it seems like it is taking the simple and making it complicated.
It's giving the simple in sutra form. So sutra only uses as many syllables as it is necessary to explain the point. Right? Difficulty is that you have to have a certain amount of knowledge to be able to appreciate the sutra. Right? Does that make sense? You know, it's just like if I say, the apple doesn't fall very far from the tree. That's a sutra. You know, and then somebody would say, well, it depends how big the tree is. You know, I mean, it's like, you know, I mean, if it's on the top of the tree and it falls from there, I mean, that's 30 feet. That's a long way to fall. But the point you're being making is that, you know, here's the tree and there's the apple. So they're still connected. They're still in association with each other. Meaning that the tree, the apples are there and the tree is not far away.
The apple doesn't fall far from the tree. That means the sun really reflects the Father.
That's what we mean.
Oh, okay.
That's what we mean. We have the tree, which is the Father, and the apple being the sun. It's not very far away.
Correct.
You know, I mean, they're connected. That's the point.
Also personality and...
That's what it's meant. It's meant in relation to that. It's not meaning physical. But the point is that, you know, the tree and the apples, you know, it's... You're using that analogy of the proximity.
So it's kind of a poetic form, sutras.
Yes, it's poetic, but it's intellectual poetic. Right? It's not emotional poetic, like you'll find in the Puranas. Does that make sense? You know, it's just like there, it's the heisei. Yeah, it means intellectually it works, you know. He walks, he does not walk, he's near, but he's very far away. You know, so, you know, you wouldn't use that in the romantic sense. You know, the boy wouldn't tell the girl, you're very beautiful, but you're not beautiful at all. You know, he wouldn't say like that. She's kind of like, what do you mean? You know, you as a person are very beautiful, but it's not that, how you say, the lacking of, you know, someone else will think it's on, you know, some other external forms. It's not that kind of beautiful. This is as a person you're beautiful, like this and that. And so, you know, it's not going to work very well, right? And a good question. So that means, it means you're saying physically I'm not very beautiful. No, you're physically beautiful also, but we're saying you're more than, well then why didn't you say that in the first place? You know, it's not going to work.
So like even these sutras, like for Vaishnavas and for devotees, they read them and they immediately understand.
Yeah, they understand. No. Because that's just, the Upanishads in essence give the complete philosophy in a very succinct way. So, but the point is, then it needs so many other prerequisites to understand it. That's why the Bhagavatam is just so straightforward, right? It's also poetic, but it uses the classical poetic sense rather than the Vedic poetic sense. So it's just so much easier like that. It's more natural like that. But they are written so that those who are attracted by jnana and karma can then take this and get distracted by knowledge. Because that's how they want to keep themselves busy. So then, it's just like the other aspects, the purva aspects, the samhita and the brahmanas. then that the karmis get distracted by that, all the different rituals they can perform, what benefits they can get from those rituals. So they can either use that for Krishna consciousness or to get distracted, just like the Uttara part, then the Aranyakas and the Upanishads can be used either to understand Krishna and serve Krishna or to get distracted by knowledge. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yes.
My question, just a small detail, even though that there is that chance for the Supreme Lord can be realized from the Brahmajyoti platform, one still has to come down to the material world and engage in devotional service in order to get Krishna power.
Yes, like that. And so unless you figure that out while you're still here, because the only ones that can, from the Brahmajyoti, move forward are only those who have had experience of the Lord before entering the Brahmajyoti. Right? So, as a person. So, because forward from the Brahmajyoti is to the Vaikuntha planets, you know, to the personal. So, your personalist, then they don't know about the person. Right? They don't know about the personality of Godhead. They only know about the Brahmajyoti of Godhead. Right? So they will get to the, if they merge into the Brahman, then there's only the Brahman. And then from there, the natural position of the living entity to engage the senses and mind and intelligence. There is no opportunity because there's no other understanding of that than the material. So they would have to come back here. The demon, he's been killed personally by the Lord. So now he can either remember activities here or remember the Lord. And then from the Lord, then he can move forward. But as we see, how many demons are personally killed by the Lord, right? So in the last, you know, this half of the life of Brahma, you know, Hiranyakashipu, you know, Hiranyaksha, Ravana, you know, Haishe, Shishupal, Dantavakra, you know, there's a few. So you would not be able to take that as a path. Yes, I'll become the biggest demon and then Krishna will kill me, and then from that, you know, why go to so much trouble? Because since you're going to have to make really a serious endeavor to be such a big demon. I mean, it's a lot of work, right? A lot of austerity. Hiranyakashipu, you know, stood on his toes, you know, in Talasan. Talasan means you stand on your toes and your hands up in the air like that, because that's like tall leaves. You know, when you're going out on the left, there's a tree there. It's got leaves that come out. They're like round with the pokey things. So like that. He stood like that for thousands of years. Or, you know, however long it was. The white ants ate his body. So there's nothing. It's just bones. And he's still meditating. That's trouble. Right? You would have to admit that that's a lot of problem. Right? Then after that, he got the benediction that he could be such a big demon. But he started out to have... What piety would have to have had to be able to do that? You know what I'm saying? So it doesn't look like it would be a path worth attempting. You know? Like that. Is that okay? Yeah. Therefore, it is advised here that one should not take up this troublesome path of self-realization, because there is uncertainty in the ultimate result. Right? So just look at it. You're not certain. Why would you engage in something that's not certain? If you had an option between devotional service that is certain and the impersonal path, which is uncertain, which would you take? You know, especially you're talking about eternal here. You know, why waste your time? Okay. One should not take up the process of Jnana Yoga. A living entity is eternally an individual soul. And if he wants to merge into the spiritual whole, he may accomplish the realization of the eternal and knowledgeable aspects of his original nature. Right? Eternal and knowledgeable, so sat and chit. Right? So through using chit, he comes to situating himself only in sat. Right? Only in eternality. Right? But no ananda. They talk about ananda, but the ananda is by not engaging. In other words, there's no material problem, that will be ananda, right? You know, just like, everyone's driving you nuts at work, you know, this and that, kids, so many different things, you know, it's the end of the month, it's the end of the year, you know, so all the different things that one has to do. So one who just would like to go into a quiet place, there's nobody, nothing going on, you have nothing to do, no obligation. And then those few moments, that's, this is nice, right? So it's not actually ananda in itself. So the Brahmananda, they call it Brahmananda. But if it's ananda, that's different from sat. Right? Because now you're defining. There's eternality and there's bliss. Right? And the process they used was knowledge. So therefore they're defining three different aspects. But they'll say it's all one and there's no difference. Right? So they're only going to end up with sat. Yes.
So when they're using knowledge but not getting knowledge, is that because it's mundane knowledge that they're using?
It's not mundane. You would say it's mundane because they're applying it for themselves, selfishly, so that makes the mundaneness. Otherwise, there's no such thing as mundane knowledge.
No, that's
all knowledge is Veda. But because you're using that knowledge of the Veda not in connection with the Lord, therefore it's called mundane knowledge. Right? And then you cultivate this mundane knowledge. So you find various more and further little aspects of this. Because this mundane knowledge doesn't need to be cultivated. You only need to cultivate what's going to be useful in God consciousness. So one's occupation may have so many details of practical knowledge, but they're only what's useful in your lifestyle as a devotee. Otherwise, you know, universities are full of theses that are, you know, 300 pages, generally speaking, of something quite useless. No one's going to use it in their life. You know, they're not. You know, the particular, how you say, sociological community of the, you know, how you say, Western Central African tsetse fly. You know, I'm sure if you look, there's a thesis there. But what's it going to do for you? How often do you get a tsetse fly in London? Right? But if you do, watch out. If they bite you, you got a problem.
Already.
Yeah. Does that work?
Yep.
Okay. A living entity is eternally an individual soul. So like in London, you'd have Watch the Gap, right? You could have Watch the Tsitsi, right? Now, if he wants to merge into the spiritual whole, he may accomplish. Okay. He may accomplish the realization of the eternal and knowledgeable aspects of his original nature. But the blissful portion is not realized. Right? That can only be realized in Krishna consciousness. Right? So sat and chit. By the grace of some devotee, such a transcendentalist, highly learned in the process of jnana yoga, may come to the point of bhakti yoga or devotional service. Because then you're adding ananda. Because it's not complete. The karmis and the yogis, they're not dealing with these others. Or the karmi deals with ananda, but not generally sat and chit. Or he may use you know, knowledge, proper knowledge, produce proper sacrifices and activities to get the knowledge. But he's not working on the sat platform, or the eternal platform, the soul. Right? Does that make sense? So that's the difficulty.
So it's like button pushing. Push one down and the other.
Yeah, the other one pops up. Yeah, so it's a problem if there's no balance here. So only the devotee, you have sat, chit, and ananda being engaged properly. At that time, long practice and impersonalism also becomes a source of trouble because he cannot give up the idea, right? Just as someone has trouble giving up the idea of sense gratification or of sinful activities, or the same thing is someone will have trouble with giving up pious activities or the impersonal concept. Right? You know, it's like that, those, who it was, it's somebody from the Lower East Side came to visit Prabhupada. I think they came from the, may have come from, who was it? Maybe it was Mukunda, or they came from the Village Voice. So they came into where Prabhupada was staying, into the loft. And as he comes in, then there's all these different persons sitting all around the room, like looking at the wall and doing different things. And so then they found, but they didn't see, you know, Prabhupada's. But they saw in the corner there was kind of like some blankets put up. So they figured, well, maybe that's kind of like a staying place, right? So he looks behind that, and Prabhupada's there. He asks, you know, oh, what are they doing? You know, because he's interested, oh, what is this process and all that? He says, I don't know what they're doing. You know, they're doing whatever they want to do. You know, he sits and chants Hare Krishna with them. He doesn't sit there and stare at a wall. You know, so that they're doing on their own. Right? Like that. So here's that, because he cannot give up the idea. Right? You know, that's the... Therefore, an embodied soul is always in difficulty with the unmanifested. Unmanifest, both at the time of practice and at the time of realization, right? Because it doesn't deal with Ananda. That's why we see it's when we're dealing with it. When Krishna is talking about Brahman, you know, in the universal form, how is it being related? Right? No, you understand? How is it being related? Just as Brahman.
With qualities.
And not only that, it's connected to Krishna, the person. I am the taste of water. So the taste in water, just that taste, that's the Brahman platform. Just that inherent taste, the experience. That's what I mean about the, what was it? The non-perceptual feelings, right? In other words, there's the taste I'm getting in water that the tongue, you know, is touching the water and what sensation is being given there in that experience, right? But we're talking about the taste itself. That's the non-perceptual feeling. You understand? Because it's not perceived of by the senses. Right? Does that make sense?
And then you're drinking some water and you're wondering if it's sweet and stuff like that. And then when something hits you, this is taste of water.
Yeah, but it's not the taste experience, it's the taste itself. That's Krishna. You know what I'm saying? You know, that because that's what you're actually looking for. There's an experience in it. You know what I'm saying? The person's on the roller coaster ride, it goes up and down, it makes him sick, it does this and that, people are screaming. These are all the experience of it. But the real point of going on it is to get scared. You go on the roller coaster ride and you're not scared, you don't go again, because it means it didn't accomplish. You know what I'm saying? You jump off the bridge on that rubber band, you know, and then, you know, unless it was exciting and, you know, the adrenaline, unless it was there, then you wouldn't do it again. Right? So there's an essential point that's there. That's what Krishna is talking about. That's the Brahman. Because that's what's pervading everything. The other things are simply, you know, matter contacting matter. But the potency that makes matter appear to be real and appear to be alive, right? What gives value to matter, that's Brahman. Does that make sense? So then he's defining that, but it's always in relationship to him. He's that. So therefore the devotee can use it very comfortably, very naturally. Right? Does that make sense? But then only in relation to the service, because gyan is always subservient to devotional service. Right? But still, it's the person. So Krishna is so kind that he gives water to, you know, satisfy our thirst. Right. So then you just go from that first step that's there, and then to the person. So you find the person through the symptom, through the imminent. Right. It means you don't see Krishna in the water. But from the taste, then you can appreciate. So through the imminent, then you're understood. Then you connect to the person. Does that make sense? If, you know, in other words, if you don't connect directly to the person, then this through the Brahman, you can get there. Right? Is that what he said? Same way as with the Paramatma. When he's defining Paramatma, how is he defining him? Right? Also, the point is relationship to him. But the Paramatma is him. But the point is Paramatma being seen simply as the controller, the all-pervading, like that. It's not really much different than the Brahman. That's why it says localized. The personal feature is there, but localized to that specific situation. Right? And he's in control of Brahman. Right? Because you're controlling the material energy means you're controlling Brahman. Does that make sense? But then it's a person who is doing that. So therefore, again, it brings it back to Krishna. Does that make sense? But then what you don't like the taste about it means it's not having that particular quality. You know what I'm saying? But it still means when you drink water, you don't think, wow, how wet this is. This is so wet. I was so dry, and now this water is making me so wet. You know what I'm saying? Like that. I think all the drunks sing about that, right? That makes sense. You understand? No, but the point is this. But what do you notice about the water?
The taste.
The taste.
But that's what I was just asking.
That's the point is, so the taste is Krishna.
Yeah.
But the point is there's, you know, not nice taste, and there's not so nice, but still that potency of taste is Krishna. Is that every living soul is partially independent, and one should know for certain that this unmanifested realization is against the nature of a spiritual blissful self. Right? Because sat simply means that you're situated on the spiritual platform. You are spirit, you're situated in spirit. But that's all there is, that's unnatural. Right? Does that make sense? It's just like, let's say we have a car, and there's no wheels on it. Right? It's unnatural. You know, car means four wheels. Right? Does that make sense? You know, if it has four wheels, right, but no motor or anything, and you just use your feet, we still can think of it as a car. Does that make sense? So the wheels are the, you know, important. So there's no wheels. So it's not natural. So sat without chit and ananda is unnatural. Right? It's against the nature of the blissful self. That's why I use it. The spirit of his spiritual blissful self. So that means the eternally blissful. Right? So it's just eternal. One should not take up this process. Right? Does that make sense? That doesn't mean we don't use this knowledge Krishna gives us about the universal form for devotional service if there's something that we're attached to that we're having difficulty connecting it to Krishna in the direct way. So then one uses through the indirect. But for us it's direct and indirect, not personal and impersonal. Does that make sense? Because the impersonal is a feature of the person. Right? The person's first. For every individual living entity, the process of Krishna consciousness, which entails full engagement in devotional service, is the best way. Right? So that means for everybody. The other one, if you're super intelligent, super determined, have certain piety, then you could take it up. But you have to be so qualified, and then it's so troublesome. While if that same intelligent person applied that in devotional service, it would be so easy for them. Not only that, the common person who doesn't have those qualifications, they can do devotional service, though they can't do jnana yoga. Yes.
It seems like with the nature of devotional service being distinct from serving the senses and like that, the analytical study is valuable for devotional service. So you can understand, am I engaged in devotional service?
Yes.
Until it's spontaneous.
Yes.
But in and itself, just analytical study isn't going to be satisfying.
No, because it's only dealing with knowledge there. And your purpose is only sat, so there's no ananda. I mean, because one has intelligence and one defines that if I deal intellectually in a nice way, you know, a logical way, that will make me happy. But they don't actually understand that that happiness they're gaining is because of the nature of the soul. They're completely missing that. So that means that's why we say less intelligent. Though they're so intelligent materially, but they're less intelligent. Right. Yeah. If one wants to ignore this devotional service, there is the danger of turning to atheism. Right? Because the impersonal could become atheistic. Right? Like that. So there is that he doesn't know the person. Right? But he could turn into, you know, like the Mayavadis. They're atheists. Okay. Thus, the process of centering attention on the unmanifested, the inconceivable, which is beyond the approach of the senses, as already expressed in this verse, should never be encouraged at any time, especially in this age. So it says centering attention on the unmanifested. No, this is a side thing. That everything's for Krishna, but this one thing I'm attached to, so what is it I'm attached to in it? So I'll think it's the thing itself, then you go into it. No, it's actually this aspect of it. That's the unmanifested that makes it work. So therefore, that's Krishna. And so right now, you've already started to break that attachment by using the knowledge. Like you're saying here, you have the vidhi, and then with knowledge, you make that solid until it becomes spontaneous. It is not advised by Lord Krishna. So here's another where Krishna himself doesn't advise us. Okay. And so here we have a footnote. Yes. One may be curious to know how the impersonalists explain this verse. Below is a summary of Sripad Shankaracharya's commentary on 12.5 as presented by Srila Baladeva Vidyabhushan. Right? So we're hearing Shankar. Because otherwise, let's read the verse again so that we understand how do they deal with these things. Right? For those whose minds are attached to the unmanifested impersonal feature of the Supreme, advancement is very troublesome. To make progress in that discipline is always difficult for those who are embodied. Right? So that's not going to bode well to the budding, impersonalist here. You know, so Shankara has to make a comment to keep them inspired. Right? <Like that. laughs> Others explain this section as follows, right? In other words, the others. Yeah. Right? They're always something you have to worry about, right? Like that. Brahman has two forms, with qualities, saguna, and without qualities, nirguna. Worship of the Lord with qualities is easily performed with attention, because it supplies a form as an object of concentration. Worship of the Lord without qualities is difficult to perform, and is done without proper attention, because of lack of object of concentration. So right there, they're just looking at it. You're dealing with Brahman, because if we say everything is Brahman, you have to accept. Then there's saguna and nirguna, right? So the difficulty here is that they'll say nirguna is the higher, and saguna is the lower. But, and we'll put it the other way. But still, even that focus just on saguna and nirguna, that's not the focal point. The focal point has to be on the person, right? So here, the Brahman without qualities is called aksharam, right? Because there's nothing to concentrate on, so you're used to engaging the senses, there's nothing there to engage, so it's difficult. For defining Brahman without qualities, 7 descriptive terms are given, right? Though it can't be described. It is beyond the scope of the Vedas, or words, anir deshyam. Because it is devoid of class, and other qualifications, avyaktam. It is pervasive, sarvatragam. and not comprehended by the mind, achintyam. Shruti say, yato vacho nivartante aprapya manasasaha. Words along with the mind return without attaining it. Taittiriya Upanishad 2.4.1. The word is called false, kutam. The world is called false, kutam. Right, in other words, not comprehended by the mind, because the mind and the words try to obtain, but they can't actually define it, so they have to return back without having obtained. Right? The world is false, kutam, since it appears real when it is actually illusory. The Atma is situated within this world, this false world, kutastam. That Atma is situated as substratum for false attributes. The Atma is without change, achalam. It is eternal, dhruvam. Right? Dhruvam also means fixed. Right? For those persons striving to know the Atma without qualities, there are great difficulties. First in digesting the meaning of the Upanishads, after service the Guru, then in contemplating the Atman, finally in meditating on Atman. The first type of person, utilizing Brahman with qualities, without undergoing these difficulties, attains realization of Atman, which wipes out ignorance and its effects. This arises from the mercy of the Lord with qualities, who has been described by Guru. He then attains liberation in the form of oneness with the nirguna Atma, devoid of quality, which gives rise to the form of the Lord. The final result is the same, but one path is filled with difficulty and therefore inferior. The idea is foolish because the Vedanta Sutras reject the idea of Brahman having two forms, with the words gati samanyat. Only one conception of Brahman is taught, Vedanta Sutra 1.1.10. This one Brahman is to be known by the Vedas. Yaya tad aksharam adhigam yate. The indestructible, the akshara, is attained by that knowledge, Mukunda Upanishad 1.1.5. Thus it is not anirdesyam, indescribable by the Vedas, as interpreted by the impersonalists. Now, Krishna is known as anirdesya. I think that's the 64th quality. No, that's it. Oh, I think no. It's one of the qualities. So he's saying here, this idea is the Mayavadis will describe this two kinds of forms of Brahman, nirguna and saguna, right? And so they'll be saying, so you're trying to attain the saguna, which has these seven qualities, right? So the lower, the with qualities is lower. But he's pointing out here is that the Shastra doesn't support this. There's no such thing as being two kinds of Brahman. No, there's Brahman. Right? Does that make sense? Like that. So you don't have two forms of unmanifest. So they're just saying this to try to get around the philosophy. Statements such as words cannot describe it would apply to all aspects of Brahman, and thus there is no reason to assume the existence of two Brahmans, one of which has form and can be approached by the senses. Because if you're saying it can't be described, right, which was the first one, right? It can't be described, then why would you describe two? One which you can approach and therefore describe and the mind can catch. Right? So if it's anirdesya, means it is. The Brahman without qualities cannot be observed anywhere because it is impossible to prove the existence of a nirguna object, since the word nirguna, without quality, has no power to denote anything. Right? The word can't describe anything. So therefore, how will you be able to appreciate it? You know, saying no qualities. What has no qualities?
Nothing.
There's nothing that has no qualities. So therefore, what does it define? It doesn't define anything. So it doesn't have any potency. Right? This is far out. No? This is a level in which the acharyas will take apart an argument. You know, so it's like what we were discussing yesterday. Then the comment was meant that, you know, the discussion and analyzing it was threadbare. Now it means down to the threads. Well, the acharyas take the threads apart. You know, there's three strands, they take those apart, right? You know, so it leaves you with the Mahayavadi with nothing. You know, it doesn't even have a syllable left. You know.
But that's essentially what he wants, isn't it?
Yeah, but he didn't want you to do that with his philosophy and process. You know, he wanted you to do that with the material phenomena. Like that. Right? The Brahman without qualities cannot be observed anywhere. It means it doesn't exist. Right? Because it is impossible to prove the existence of a nirguna object. You can't prove it. How do you prove the thing has no qualities? Because to be able to discuss it or observe it or something, you have to have a quality you're working with, right? Even they're saying it's nirguna Brahman, but then they're going to say there's seven descriptive terms. But they're using their mind and intelligence to grasp it with. So they're already saying that it's what was it? Achintyam. But they're using these terms so that their mind, so it is chintya, able to be contemplated. Right? Because the mind contemplates. So they're able to do that. But achintya means you can't contemplate. So how do you understand an object that's uncontemplatable? That has no cause. So it doesn't exist.
How can they say it's pervasive and that's not a quality? Or?
All of them are qualities. Yes. So they're describing only certain aspects. They're appreciating certain aspects of the Saguna Brahman. Mm. But because they don't accept qualities like greatness or heroism or happiness or these, which are also qualities of Brahman, they therefore, you know, come to the idea that, if I only accept these seven, then it's nirguna. But if it's actually nirguna, you don't accept any of them. You know, and then along with that, that means you can't even describe it as nirguna, because nirguna, there is no such thing as nirguna. You know what I'm saying? So the idea of actually of Mayavad philosophy and that doesn't exist. It is just like any other mundane. I will be happy in the material world is a total illusion, an absolute illusion. So the idea that there is nirguna Brahman, that is also an absolutely false, illusory concept. Right? It is consequently a useless, since the word nirguna, without quality, has no power to denote anything, right? Because you say table, it denotes something, so it has a value. But nirguna doesn't denote anything, so it has no use. Because Brahman also has those seven, you know, terms that are used. So that means if it's nirguna, you couldn't even use those. So that means it doesn't have any value. It is consequently a useless term. And we must accept that all scriptures are meant to describe Brahman. The word kuta cannot mean false word because kutasta is defined in the dictionary as that object which remains always in one state. Thus it refers to Atma. So it's always in one state. How can it be illusion? How can it be covered by illusion? Right? You know, how could the Brahman be covered by and then change? How could Brahman separate into, you know? But if it's kutasta, means it will never change. Right? The world is also not false, but real according to the Srutis. Yes?
So the Atma is kutasta, so the quality is ananda. The quality
is satchidananda.
And that is unchanging.
Yeah. No, the soul never satchidananda. But how he wants to situate himself, that can either be in the spiritual or the material. What knowledge he wants to use is either connected to the Lord and is therefore transcendental, or not connected as material. Right? And whether that ananda is a connection with the Lord, so it's actually transcendental, or it's simply removal of pain, you know, removal of obstacles. Does that make sense? Oh, that gives a very nice point, just so we mentioned that. This is another angle on the mode of passion. Because the mode of passion is great endeavor to get an object, right? So now, the mode of passion generally indicates they want big happiness out of something, right? You know, they're not going to work for something small. So that means if the material definition, or it means, not say if, being that the material definition of happiness is removal of pain, right? Right? You're hungry. So the more hungry you are, it means the greater the pain, the greater the enjoyment of eating. Does that make sense? You know, the more you're tired, then the greater the happiness of sleeping. Does that make sense? You know, so that would indicate that that greatness of the pleasure that comes from the mode of passion means that there, by definition, has to be greater obstacles to remove to obtain it. Because as removing the obstacle gives the pleasure. So removing a small obstacle gives small pleasure. Removing a big obstacle means big pleasure. So mode of passion means you're automatically accepting, I'm going to go through a lot of trouble to be happy in the mode of passion.
That's inherent.
Yeah, it's inherent. Right? Well, the mode of ignorance, I won't actually know if I'm happy or not. You know, like that. That's kind of, you know. Okay, then according to the Shrutis, Kavir Mani Shi Pari, oh, this is Ishupanishad. Kavir Mani Shi Pari Bhuswayam Bhurya Tat Yator Tan Vyaradhas Chasvati Vyasama Bhya. He creates Vyaradhat, since time immemorial, all real objects. Yatatayatan Artan, because he knows all, Kavi, is intelligent, Manasi, Manishi. Controls all, Padibhu, and is independent, Swayambhu. By his own energy, he performs all acts. Ishupanishad Mantra 8. Right? So, it's real. But, it's just, we think it's not connected to the Lord. Therefore, that's the illusion. Right? We're walking around in a real world, but in our mind, what we're, how we're interpreting and seeing and interacting is total illusion. That's the... Since the Shrutis testify that the form of the Supreme Brahman, full of knowledge and bliss, is Krishna, who drinks the milk of the breast of Jashoda, the concoction of an aksharam devoid of qualities, situated within the body of Krishna, must be considered a result of blind faith. It has no basis in proper reasoning or scriptural proof. Therefore, it is rejected. So in other words, saying that there's two Brahmans here, because then they're going to apply this, that the Brahman of Krishna, the Saguna Brahman of Krishna on the battlefield, you know, is speaking all this knowledge, but actually it's the Nirguna Brahman within Krishna that is the supreme that he's talking about. Right? But he's talking about himself, so then that means that the two are non-different. You know, so here he's saying it. So since we've already established that Nirguna doesn't exist, right? And the Shrutis, what they say about he is the person doing these things. So then it can only be considered that this idea of an aksharam devoid of qualities, a Nirguna Brahman, then that means it must be based on blind faith. So the Mayavadis have blind faith in Nirguna Brahman, because there's no evidence or support of it. Right? And you couldn't experience it, because to experience it means there has to be some qualities. You can't experience nothing. Because when you say, no, I experienced, you know, the nothingness, no, you experienced peace. Right? There's no material endeavor, so therefore there's no passion and ignorance. So therefore, things were peaceful. You experienced, you know, the quality of peace of Brahman. Right? Does that make sense? Peace or relief or one of those. They're all qualities of Brahman. And so you attributed that itself is the Nirguna. But it can't be. Otherwise, how did you experience it? You know what I'm saying? So we're saying that it's... you know, not comprehended by the mind, but you went, oh, it's peaceful, it's nice. So that means it's comprehended by the mind. So that goes against your own definition. So it has to be blind faith. Right? Because every word that they define the Brahman by doesn't actually have any meaning. Right? Because you can't use a quality to describe something that has no qualities. Do you know what I'm saying?
There's a connection between the fact to have a blind face and you cannot experience it.
I didn't quite understand.
Say that Mayavadi they have blind face in Nirguna Brahman.
Yes.
And it's not possible to experience that.
Sat you can, but sat is a quality. Eternality is a quality. Because they're saying that it's no quality. You know what I'm saying? I mean, you know what I'm saying? It means in the revolution they said equity. They didn't say near-quity. Right, you know? You know, or aquity. You know, they said equity, right? So there's quality is there. Does that make sense? So even if we're saying it's that anything that can be experienced, there must be something you're experiencing with, and then you're using the mind. So you're using all these elements that they say are illusion, and then feeling that they have therefore touched the nirguna Brahman, but they haven't. They're touching Brahman, but it's saguna Brahman. Otherwise, how is it being able to be experienced? How is it able to be described? So in other words, the nirguna Brahman doesn't exist, just like you're going to be happy in the material world doesn't exist. So you're going to be happy as Brahman doesn't exist. You know what I'm saying? It's two sides of the same coin. Right? Karma and jnana are two sides of the same thing. By engaging my senses in the sense object, I'll be happy. By not engaging my senses in the sense object, I'll be happy. That's all. It's the same thing. It all comes back down again to the platform of the embodied. Is that what I'm saying?
But it means that the question is that when we experience something in life, so there is automatically some faith in it.
Yes, yes.
So someone who has no faith or blind faith, he cannot experience it.
No, blind faith you experience, but you don't necessarily know what it is. It means blind faith is that you have faith that it exists, though there's actually no real proof of it.
Yes.
You know what I'm saying? It's not actually real, so therefore it's blind faith. It means you're basing it on Shastra, then you can say it's solid. Like we were saying, Krishna is God. We're not doing it on blind faith. The scriptures are telling us. The acharyas are telling us. Is that something?
We can experience it.
We can experience it, yeah. So their experience of Brahman is actually saguna Brahman. Because that's all. Brahman is only saguna. There is only one Brahman. There's not two Brahmans. But their idea is that the nirguna is the real, and the saguna is what's not real. But it's the saguna that's real. The nirguna doesn't exist. It's only an idea. It sounds great. Simply because they're so frustrated in the material world, they want to have nothing to do with it. You know what I'm saying? You know, that you like the person, then things connect to the person you involve yourself with. You don't like the person, then you don't want to have anything to do with. So that's the whole idea, is that their mind, their senses have given, their body has given, the relationships have given them problems. Right, emotions. So they want a platform that doesn't have any of these left. So then you're going to say no cause. So that's near going to, it sounds perfect. You know what I'm saying? You have so many people, they come up with the perfect ideal, but it's not real. You know what I'm saying? The whole point, all these ideals are not real because they're not connected to the Lord. You know, it's like you have concept, of world peace and harmony, but the point is it's not a reality because you have the divine and the demoniac natures. So it means the divine may be able to work together, but the demoniac won't. to cooperate with other demoniac to get the maximum out of the divine. You know, but once there's no more divine left, you know, there's only the demoniac, then they'll fight amongst themselves. Does that make sense? So it sounds great, right? But it never is great, you know. But everyone is equal. There's no difference, and everyone will get what they need according to their ability. Sounds great. But the point is, who's to decide what is his actual ability and how much he should get? So that means you've already established an authority. But the whole system is to run without any authority. Right? There's this coming, we just all, because of the good naturedness, all work together. But the point is who decides? So it's like the individual will decide. Yes, he's an intellectual. He may be able to do that. But your common person won't be able to do that. Right, so you can only run that with intellectuals, right? And who's the first ones they kill? The intellectuals. But they're the only ones that actually could practice it, technically, right? But even then, the point is that's going on, that you're satisfied with just whatever you get according to your simple endeavor. You know, just the bare necessity. But how many people are satisfied like that? Even intellectuals. Right? Therefore, it can't function. It means it sounds great. But it's like, you know, how you say, you know, sky flowers or pie in the sky. Or...
Huh? Yeah, pie in the sky.
Mention in the sky.
Mention?
Flying.
Castle.
Yeah, castle in the sky. Yeah, like that. Mention, yeah. It's all these things that they're not there. They don't exist. It can't happen. What do you say?
So, this seems, from what you're saying, it occurred to me that communism was something created by intellectuals for the common man, not something created of the common man to practice. But
yeah.
And then there's that whole thing that they kill everyone who isn't...
isn't common, yeah. But the point is, who's killing them?
And
a common person?
Of the hierarchy enjoying from the common man.
Yeah, but the point is, it's the hierarchy that's getting rid of the intellectuals. Because they're higher than the administrators. Right? So they're a threat. But the point is unless you know what the common man is, how do you make a philosophy for the common man? But the point is we don't define what's the common man. God does. So unless you know God, how can you know man?
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying? Therefore, the system that's God conscious, that can be, you know, work in all situations. But that's the whole point, is that all these different systems are indicative that there's that variety of personalities. Right? I mean, You have the communism looking at it from the intellectual point of view, which would put it as a higher element. But its application, how it's defined, is for the lowest. Right? But you know what I'm saying, capitalism is there. You know, then you have your democracy, you have your monarchy, your oligarchy, then you have like this, you know, I mean, anarchy. All these different systems are there, but they apply to certain situations with certain people. And so it works nicely in a certain sense, just like you have a ship. And it works because everybody does their specific job when they're supposed to. Then it works. But if everything goes completely haywire, then anarchy is the solution. Then it's every man for himself. But until that point, so it only has it's useful in that point. Right? But other than that point, it has no use. So therefore, all of these systems have their use in a specific point. That the common man should be taken care of. That's the point. But that there shouldn't be people taking care of them, that's stupid. You know what I'm saying? You know, that you have capitalism and you have democracy, that's fine. But who sets the standards? The common person can't set the standard. The common person can work for his own prosperity without being blocked because of someone else's material motive. You know, they're also economic motive. Then that's good. But to say is, therefore, money is the standards by which we define everything in human life and in the universe, that's foolish. Right? That you have authority and that they make the decision. Then that's fine. It's very efficient management. But it's only efficient as long as they're working for the benefit of the people, because it's a social system. It's not a system meant for one man. Right? You know, the country's not meant one man's going to get benefit, no one else does. It's meant the whole country benefits. Right? You understand? So each one has its strength and weakness. So it has a place to be put. Does yeah. That make sense? Yeah. Is that okay?
Yes.
But?
I have a really good question. It's about the knowledge.
The knowledge. A little louder.
Yes, when you speak about, I think the Buddhist knowledge is Sarasvati.
Yes.
So, in our relationship with Keshava Kashmiri, so he was like a personalist and actually changed his consciousness. So how can this, what I have difficulty to understand today, it's about if the devotional path is very clear, so why
couldn't Keshava Kashmiri understand that?
Yes,
because it's covered. Maya covers their illusion. That's why mayayat prityajana means their knowledge is stolen by illusion. It doesn't mean, knowledge means actually understanding the personality of Godhead. That's what's taken. It's not that they don't know the facts and figures of their grammar or their particular, you know, art or science. It just means that they don't actually can't see its connection to the Lord. The knowledge comes from the Lord. Is that something? Because this conditioning means you have faith that I will can be happy separate from the Lord. So you're already working on the principle of illusion. Right? So that illusion can take two major categories. That I will enjoy the senses separate from the Lord and be happy. Or I will not enjoy the senses separate from the Lord and be happy. Is that what it says?
Means that the person with the Maya Nadi means he does not want to accept Krishna as well.
No, he doesn't, because they've had problem with the senses and personalities and all that, so they want to have nothing to do with that. So though they're all of their work, all their philosophy, all their discussion, all their sadhana, all their practices, all their contemplation is all on Saguna Brahman. But their idea is that, but beyond that is Nirguna Brahman. Right, so they've simply taken the principle of envy to the extreme. Envy so much that the person doesn't have any, you know, any qualities. Right? You don't like the person, you know, you want to, you know, remove his head or something. But at least you leave the body. And, you know, the head can be there, but it just shouldn't be connected to the body. But here you're taking it where they shouldn't even have a head, a body, senses, an existence, nothing. So that's very extreme ending. You know, because they're so frustrated on trying to be the control and enjoy that didn't work, therefore they've gone to the extreme opposite.
And that lustful mentality of over there is better than over here drives them to continue to try to find something that doesn't actually
work. Because the point is they're trying to be an enjoyer, because they talk about Brahmananda. So they still want to be happy, and they want to be the controllers, that I can't do it by my actions and with the senses and all that, but I can be the supreme controller by being Brahman, by being God. Because if I merge with that, and we're all, it's all one, so I become the supreme, and then I will be supremely happy. So it still is, I'm the controller and the joy. That's why they can't get into the spiritual world. Because even if they situated themselves there, they still wouldn't be in the spiritual world. Right? If an impersonalist went into Vaikuntha, he would still be in the material world. Right? Because the concept that there's something separate than God is the material concept. He's situated spiritually. It's whether he's in Brahman, the material world, or in Vaikuntha, he's only seeing the eternal aspect of all three. Right? But the actual nature of it, he's seeing it separate from the Lord. So therefore it's material. Because that's what's material. It's not seeing a connection with the Lord. So any knowledge not connection with the Lord, any engagement, any result like that. Does that make sense? So that's why a Mayavadi or an impersonalist can walk into Braj in Bomalila. But in Goloka there's tridents all around that if they get close they'll just, you know, cut them to shreds. So, you know, they're not going to get close. Just because they're a disturbance. They already have a place that you want to disturb. You walk in there. You know, you're going to leave us alone up here. Right? You know, so, because one may ask, no, but why would you need that? Because it's, you know, says, no, but if they went in, then they would be in the spiritual world. No, they wouldn't be in the spiritual world. You know, because the spiritual world's not a situation. The spiritual world is a mentality.
You know, so what? Are Mayavadis counted as demons?
Are Mayavadis counted as demons? Well, in the Upanishad, it mentions that the killer of the soul, they'll live in the darkest regions of hell. So, it didn't even say the light ones. You know, it's not. You know, it's not the. They're not going to be in the white collar hell, right? You know, they're going to be in the high security. You know, like that. Okay. That's why when we discuss with about, when we're talking about Brahman and all that, we generally refer to them as Brahmavadis. Mm-hmm. Because that it's only possible that Mayavadis, technically speaking, aren't going to get anything except going to hell. Mm-hmm. Right? Because it's voidism. There's nothing there. You know, so, but the it means that the piety of following the Veda, following their sadhana and that they'll have. But the point is preaching bogus philosophies and influencing others.
Spreading it around.
Yeah. Then they're going to suffer for that. But then once they finish suffering, they come back to human life. They'll have that piety. That won't be lost. But unfortunately, that piety has only been applied to Mayavad philosophy. So again, then they will become a Mayavad. So it's useless. But the Brahmavadi, you have the option of being situated on the Brahman platform, being able to understand that the transcendental platform is different from that. Like we see the example of Four Kumaras or Sukadeva Goswami. They can appreciate the difference. Therefore, then they went from that mundane concept of I am the controller and enjoyer, but situated on the spiritual platform to I am the servant, and Krishna is the enjoyer. So the false ego is removed. So then you can actually be situated in the spiritual world. That's eternal. The other one, you can be situated, but temporarily. Like the demon comes into Vrindavan, but how long does he stay? Right? Not very long. Mother Ashoda has been there a while, and she's going to be there a while, but you know, she's always been there. The demon comes in and gets killed. He has to, you know, he leaves. So it's like that. You know? So it's, I think Kamsa even came, but then Purnamasi, because she was, that was around the place where Vyasadeva wrote the 10th canto, because the Mathura road comes there, right? So he came into Vrindavan at that point, because all these demons are being killed, they want to know what's going on there. So he came himself, you know? And as soon as he came, then there's a little pond there, not far away. There's a little hill there, over the hill there's a pond. So Purnamasi was there with some other gopis and they're washing clothes or whatever they're doing. He came by and was, you know, to ask, you know, who, where is this Krishna and this and that. So Purnamasi just reached over, grabbed him, turned him into a gopi, you know, young gopi, maidservant, said, okay, now wash pots, you know, here, you know, wash clothes, do this, engaging him all day, do this, do that, all this menial service, you know, so this big, but he's still, you know, mentality still Kamsa, right? You know, so that's a problem, right? Big Kamsa, strong as 10,000 elephants, and now you're a little gopi and you're having to wash, because this older lady is telling you what to do and you can't do anything about it. So then after a while, then he said, please, they like that. He said, okay, as long as you never come back here. So then turned him back into Kamsa, and then he left and never came back. So you never hear of him coming to Vrindavan. How's that? You know, you just send more demons. Let them go deal with the old lady, right? Yeah. Okay, so in other words, just as the karmi has blind faith that he'll be happy by engaging the senses, the mayavadi has blind faith that by not engaging the senses in nirguna brahman, he will be happy. The only happiness he's getting on the path is dealing with saguna brahman. Right? What little he's gaining from the path. But it doesn't exist. And it really just doesn't exist. Right? This is the acharyas. They are able to bring out just a simple point, how they're working with the saguna and nirguna simultaneously, but taking the nirguna as supreme. 12:6-7. But those who worship me, giving up all their activities unto me, and being devoted to me without deviation, engaged in devotional service and always meditating upon me, having fixed their minds upon me, O son of Prita, for them I am the swift deliverer from the ocean of birth and death. So he'll give the standard, you know. Then he'll give the alternatives, and then he'll go back and the conclusion. So again, we see it's the same panchanganyaya. You're establishing your point. You're giving all the various reasons and then examples of other things like that, and then synthesizing and bringing it back to the conclusion. The intelligent man should take up the process of devotional service. The responsibility is taken by the Supreme Lord himself. He clearly states here that he himself becomes the deliverer. A child is completely cared for by his parents, and thus his position is secure. Similarly, a devotee does not need to endeavor to transfer himself by yoga practice to other planets. Rather, the Supreme Lord, by his great mercy, comes at once, riding on his bird carrier Garuda, and at once delivers the devotee from material existence. Right? So the yogi has to actually meditate, close all the gates, move the life airs and soul to the top of the head, and then when he's very focused, then leave the body, and then, so it's a big endeavor.
Yeah.
Like that. You know, we just mentioned the actual activity, the technical point. But we left off the 10 to 60,000 years
preparation
of preparation for that moment, right? So the devotee he depends on Krishna, and Krishna comes with Garuda and just picks the devotee up. So it's quite easy. Although a man who has fallen in the ocean may struggle very hard and may be very expert in swimming, he cannot save himself. But if someone comes and picks him up from the water, then he is easily rescued. Similarly, the Lord picks up the devotee from this material existence. One simply has to practice the easy process of Krishna consciousness and fully engage himself in devotional service. An intelligent man should always prefer the process of devotional service to all other paths. But it's, made the point. So someone who's intelligent, you can see these. That's why they're being presented. We could say, no, that's all nonsense, just do devotional service. No, it's discussed very nicely. Yeah, you can do it like this, but the point is you don't have any, by karma, you engage all these things. You suffer. This is the mode of passion. And here is that there's nothing for your nature to connect to, because you're dealing with something that has no qualities. So both of these are a great problem, right? And then the yogi, he has to go through this whole astanga system, right, to get to the point of being able to elevate himself. But the devotee gets the benefit of all of these things. He has the facility, he's liberated, and he's elevated to the transcendental realm without separate endeavor. He simply gives up all activities to Krishna. Everything he does is for Krishna. He's always, whatever he thinks of is for Krishna. Right? All of his engagements are for Krishna. Right? Vritti. In verses 12:5-7, the Lord encouraged everyone to take up the process of devotional service. Verses 12, 12:8 through 12 describe this process. 12:8. Just fix your mind upon me, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and engage all your intelligence in me. Thus you will live in me always, without a doubt. Because all your intelligence means the senses, which will include the body. Because here we've set mind and intelligence. So we mentioned mind and words. But technically, either of these include the body. The mind controls the body, the intelligence controls the senses. Does that make sense? Right? The senses are situated in the body. So just by mentioning these two, right, you've already dealt with them, right? You know, because live can also mean the situation. But does that make sense? So that's why you see sometimes the list is not seemingly full. Like, you know, the five main items of devotional service, Prabhupada only mentioned four. Right? Because association of devotees means hearing Bhagavatam. Right? Worshipping the deity means worshipping Tulsi. So you only need to mention four. By taking up the process of devotional service, the devotee establishes a direct relationship with the Supreme. One who is engaged in Lord Krishna's devotional service lives in a direct relationship with the Supreme Lord. So there is no doubt that his position is transcendental from the very beginning. A devotee does not live on the material plane. He lives in Krishna. So direct, because you're directly in contact with. Right. So here, direct relationship means that that interaction is direct. It doesn't mean that the spiritual master is bypassed. You know, just like you'll say the grandfather has a direct relationship with the grandson because they're interacting. So the interaction is direct, but technically the relationship is through the father. Right? So this is just, I'm just only bringing this out because you have these different words that may have various applications depending upon how they're being applied. Mm-hmm. 2:12:9. My dear Arjuna, O winner of wealth, if you cannot fix your mind upon me without deviation, then follow the regulative principles of bhakti yoga. In this way, develop a desire to attain me. Okay, so here now he's giving, you know, this is the best. Just fix your mind upon me. He says, just fix your mind upon me. And engage all your intelligence in me. Thus you will live in me always without a doubt. Right? In this verse, two different processes of bhakti yoga are indicated. The first applies to one who has actually developed an attachment to Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, by transcendental love. And the other is for one who has not developed an attachment for the Supreme Person by transcendental love. For this second class, there are different prescribed rules and regulations one can follow to be ultimately elevated to the stage of attachment to Krishna. Right, so if you're already you heard about Krishna, you're already attached, then you simply have to apply this verse 12:8 and just engage always in the Lord's service. But if not, if you're not on the platform of asakti, just by hearing about Krishna, then it's recommended that, therefore, you take up the prescribed rules and regulations. Right? So, therefore, what's defined in the Pancharatra system? Right? The practice of bhakti yoga brings one to the stage of love of God. This love of God is now in a dormant state in everyone's heart. And there, love of God is manifested in different ways. But it is contaminated by material association. Right? So the love of God is manifest in different ways, because actually all you're loving about the material world is God. But because of being contaminated by material association, being covered, then we're only perceiving the covering. Right? In other words, we are, you know, real, but we're covered by material energy. And the Lord has entered into everything. He's real. But he enters into it, so what we see is the covering. So in other words, our covering interacts with how Krishna's covered himself. Does that make sense? So that's what's interacting. But there's no, we are not interacting with the Lord. Technically, we're not even interacting with the object, the covering. The covering's interacting with, our covering's interacting with how Krishna covers himself. Does that make sense? This is what's actually going on here. You know, so that's why one recognizes this, and then one engages oneself in the Lord's service. So that means the coverings are only in a medium for that service. But then if that's understood, you're not covered anymore. And you see Krishna. So he's not covering himself. Right? But the medium still remains. Right? Does that make sense? Now the heart has to be purified of the material association, and that dormant natural love for Krishna has to be revived. That is the whole process. Right? So here he's just giving it in a nutshell. Our love for God manifests in different ways, but it's contaminated by material association. So the heart has to be purified of the material association, then that natural dormant love for Krishna is to be revived. That's the process. Right? So we see is that the problem is in prayojana. Right? It means that's here, the active principle. Because the Mayavadis start with the of sammandha, trying to understand the Brahman. But without seeing the prayojana aspect of the love, it makes it very difficult. But if you start with that, the other becomes more easily. You know what I'm saying? If you really like something, right, then you want to find out about it, its background and all that. You know, you meet somebody you've never met before, and, you know, you say hi, hello, but they're not very interesting to you. Then when the pleasantries finish, you go off, they go off, and you don't think anything more about it. But if the pleasantries are nice, you get in like that, you want to know who the person is. What's their background? Where they, you know, how is it, you know, all these different things. Does that make sense?
That's why the middle six chapters is prayojana in the Gita.
Yes, middle six is prayojana, like that. So this is then giving. But it's the, you know, it's the, yeah. Yeah. And that giving up the result for Krishna. Because then your process, you're dealing with prayojana. Mm. Right? Mm. So in our process, the main emphasis is in the prayojana, not in the sambandha. Mm. Right? Mm. But we know more on sambandha gyan, basically, you can say, of any other practitioner in the Vedic culture. Right? The fineness, you see, like how the acharyas, it takes that one point. How fine they make it. Right? And, you know, they could go finer, but, you know, we don't have brains for it. You know, it's like Madhvacharya was giving in his commentary on the Vishnu Sahasranam. He would give say the name, you know, because 1,000 names, so the first name. Then we'd give a translation. I think he went through all the whole thing. Then he went back in the beginning and then went through it again, giving a second meaning. Then he went back again, gave a third meaning. Then a fourth meaning, fifth meaning, up to 40th meaning. Like that. And after that, the disciples just said, that's it, we can't handle anymore. His plan was to do 108. Like that. And that would be, you know, a nice token. You know, it's 108. You know. Like that. So there's a limit how much we can handle. So the acharyas take it up to that point and stop. You know? But the good point is that God's unlimited, but we're not. So we don't need to have unlimited knowledge of the unlimited. We simply have to have knowledge of the unlimited. Does that make sense? Therefore, there's an advantage. Otherwise, you can only, you know, how much can you stuff into 1,000th tip of the hair? Right? Like that. So you don't have to worry about it. To practice, that is the whole process. To practice the regulative principles of bhakti yoga, one should, under the guidance of an expert spiritual master, follow certain principles. Expert means they know, have the knowledge, they know how to apply it. Because expert generally refers to the Abhideya aspect. Mm. Right? You know, and we're saying Nitya Siddha and prema bhakti, we're generally talking about the prayojan aspect. Mm-hmm. You know, if they say, you know, spirit wanted full knowledge, like that, you're talking about the sambandha. Mm-hmm. So when we say expert, that means inactivity. Right? And activity, chit, means knowledge and activity. So it's not that just they're sentimentally good or they just have knowledge. That's the difficulty, because many times the tendency is that in the process, in the religious process, it'll divide into two, the theologian, you know, and the priestly, you know, or the ritualistic person. So one focuses on philosophy, but not so much on the ritual. The other on the ritual, not so much on the philosophy. You know, so it's fine that that people will have their taste, but it can't be devoid of the other. You know? So the two go together. So someone who knows the philosophy and knows how to apply it, right, practically, get results, that's what one's looking for. Right? So that's why it said when choosing the spiritual master, then it's by their instructions you're able to apply them and get the result. That's how you say, this is it. Right? Because otherwise somebody could say nice things and they're very nice and practical. You know, someone has something here, someone there. So that person is consistently at works, then that is the expert spiritual master. Right? Should work under the guidance of an expert spiritual master, follow certain principles. One should rise early in the morning, take bath, enter the temple and offer prayers, and chant Hare Krishna, then collect flowers to offer to the deity, cook foodstuffs to offer to the deity, take prasadam, and so on. There are various rules and regulations which one should follow. And one should constantly hear Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam from pure devotees. This practice can help anyone rise to the level of love of God. And then he is sure of his progress into the spiritual kingdom of God. This practice of bhakti yoga under the rules and regulations with the direction of the spiritual master will surely bring one to the stage of love of God. Right? So this process here, we saw as all these different things. Now this is all Pancharatri. Mm-hmm. Rising early, taking bath, entering the temple, offering prayers, chanting Hare Krishna, collecting flowers, cooking foodstuffs, taking prasadam. It's all part of the Pancharatri process. So in other words, the first is the Bhagavat. Just surrender, do everything to Krishna. Then, if that doesn't work, then you follow the Pancharatri system. Because it's ekayana, it's focused exclusively on the Lord. Okay? 12.10. If you cannot practice the regulations of bhakti yoga, then just try to work for me, because by working for me, you will come to the perfect stage. Right? So now it's like, the other is that you're following all the rules and regulations of the devotional practice. And if that doesn't work, then do work for him. Right? Because the other one, it's your lifestyle, everything is all connected. This one, you know, is that what you do some activity for Krishna. Right? The rest of the time, you may not be able to follow the rules, but you're doing some work for Krishna. Right, that's right. The guy walks into the temple, not a devotee, but you engage him in doing some activity. Right, because he doesn't know the philosophy, he doesn't understand this connection, but he's already engaged in devotional service. Now you can explain that to him. If you can understand, great. If not, keep him busy in service. Right, so that's what Prabhupada would say, is that, you know, if you have situations where they can't understand the philosophy or aren't interested in the philosophy, then fine, kirtan and prasad. You know, they're engaged. You know, it's direct activities, topmost activities. Then from that, they'll get purified. Then they'll slowly be able to appreciate. You know, so they're having the association with devotees. They're hearing the holy name. They're taking prasad. Right? So with time, then all the rules and regulations of the Pancharatri system will have some value. One who is not even able even to practice the regulative principles of bhakti yoga under the guidance of a spiritual master can still be drawn to this perfectional stage by working for the Supreme Lord. How to do this work has already been explained in the 55th verse of the 11th chapter. One should be sympathetic to the propagation of Krishna consciousness. There are many devotees who are engaged in the propagation of Krishna consciousness, and they require help. So, even if one cannot directly practice the regulative principles of bhakti yoga, he can try to help such work. So devotees are doing so many projects and preaching, and so if one can't, you know, be absorbed like they are, then one can at least help how they're helping. They're already doing something. You like what they're doing, help with it. 11:12:11. If, however, you are unable to work in this consciousness of me, then try to act, giving up all results of your work, and try to be self-situated. Those unable to work directly for the Lord may engage in pious work. Maybe it may be that one is unable even to sympathize with the activities of Krishna consciousness because of social, familiar, or religious considerations, or because of some other impediments. Right? If one attaches himself directly to the activities of Krishna consciousness, there may be many objections from family members, or so many other difficulties. For one who has such a problem, it is advised that he sacrifice the accumulated result of his activities to some good cause. Right? Such procedures are described in the Vedic rules. There are many descriptions of sacrifices and special functions of punya, or special work, in which the result of one's previous action may be applied. Thus one may gradually become elevated to the state of knowledge, right? Because by performing karma, jnana comes. So by coming to that platform of jnana, then you can understand that what's the use of social systems and family considerations and other things, religious considerations, if it doesn't culminate in worshipping the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Then he'll be able to take up the next process up. Then he'll be able to support the work, or engage himself, or be able to surrender. But the point is that if he keeps himself pious, at least it's progressive, and people are getting some benefit, facilities being created. Right? Because generally speaking, it's the pious who surrender. Right? Rather than he sees that there's no use in anything, so he gives up his piety also. At least there's regulation. If you're pious, you have to be regulated. Right? You have to be effective. Right? You can't give in charity if you have nothing to give. How do you have something to give? You worked, you got results. Right? Does that make sense? So it's only the working person is giving in charity. Right? 12:12. If you cannot take to this process, to this practice, then engage yourself in the cultivation of knowledge. Better than knowledge, however, is meditation. And better than meditation is a renunciation of the fruits of action. For by such renunciation, one can attain peace of mind. Right? Mm-hmm. So now he brought it down. If you can't do any of the above, even being a pious guy, then you can be an impersonalist. But better than impersonalism is meditation. So of the two kinds, the yogi is better than the jnani in this case. But better than meditation is renunciation. So again, it takes it back to the last thing. At least then you try to give up the results of your work. Right? For by renunciation, you can attain peace of mind. So these other two don't really even give you peace of mind. Yes?
So Krishna is making sure that we don't think that this last one is a real option by taking it back.
I would think that's a good. Because then immediately it's like, you know, it seems, oh, okay, but yeah. Then immediately, so, but better than that is this, better than this, because he did it all in one. Because the other things you see is giving a verse or a few verses, but here it's even within one verse.
Yeah, kind of like, so you can't quote.
So it's like that, but then it's, yeah. Okay. Om Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Jaya Srila Prabhupada ki, Samaveta Bhaktivedanta ki, Janyatai Gaura Prema.